Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's very friendly conversation with the murderous president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, who he invited to the White House despite the thousands of Filipinos who have been gunned down by vigilantes urged on by Duterte. Vikram Singh, who previously served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia at the Pentagon, joins us to discuss Donald Trump's apparent affection for strongmen and how much the American president and Attorney General Sessions are sympathetic to Duterte's brutal and arbitrary crackdown on drugs, given Sessions' obsession with marijuana and his plans to revive the war on drugs. We'll assess Duterte's pivot to China and his coy remarks that he may be too busy to accept Trump's invitation because, quote, I'm supposed to go to Russia, I'm supposed to go to Israel. Then we'll examine Donald Trump's ominous use of the word criminal to describe immigrants and political opponents alike and speak with Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Propaganda Works. We will discuss his article in the New York Times, Who is a Criminal?, and investigate what agenda might be behind the dark and dystopian vision of chaos and carnage in American inner cities and at the border that Trump and Sessions are pushing as Trump dehumanizes immigrants, as he did on Saturday, calling them snakes, to wild applause from his followers. Then finally, on this May Day, we will speak with historian Jefferson Cowie, the author of Stayin' Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, whose latest book is The Great Exception, The New Deal and the Limits of American Politics. We will discuss what happened to the champions of the middle and working classes, given the lack of political opposition to Trump and the Republicans today, compared to the 1970s, when the liberals and the Democrats dominated the House, the Senate, and the Supreme Court. And joining us now is Vikram Singh, who's the Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Previously, he served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia at the Pentagon, where he advised senior leadership on all policy matters pertaining to development and implementation of defense strategies and plans for the region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vikram Singh.
Thanks for having me.
And already people are nonplussed by President Trump's extension of an invitation to Rodrigo Duterte, the murderous leader of the president of the Philippines. Human rights groups are aghast. It does look as if this is just one of those things where he has a good phone conversation. It's kind of the opposite of talking to the Australian Prime Minister, right? You have a good phone conversation and you invite him. You don't talk to your aides and nothing's cleared with anybody else, the National Security Council, the State Department. Is that what's happening? This is government by the seat of your pants?
Well, there's certainly an element of that, and that seems to be a trend that we're seeing, you know, all the time. This, the notion of, you know, listening to the last person who he was in the room with, of, you know, having a good relationship with people if they say nice, flattering things about you, that sort of thing. But I think it's there's something of a trend emerging here, and that trend is that he's having, you know, difficult conversations with our closest allies, people who have not only stood with but sent their young men and women to fight and die alongside Americans in wars throughout the 20th and 21st centuries. They're having very difficult conversations, and you know, and leaders that we should have concerns or problems with seem to be getting the best Trump treatment, and in this case, getting something that's really a precious commodity. That's the time and invitation. That's a really, really odd and really disturbing sort of throwing away, just, you know, of a key element of American power and standing.
Well, I think my objection to it is, and that certainly applies to Trump's nice things he said about Putin, is that I'm in solidarity with those young Russians demonstrating against this guy who's stolen their democracy, stolen their future, stolen their hopes, and has created a gangster state. And I'm in solidarity with the at least almost 50%, if not more, of the people in Turkey who voted against this power grab by Erdogan. And they happen to be the educated and urban people. And Trump just absolutely undercut them by calling up and congratulating Erdogan.
Right, so even Erdogan gets a congratulatory call, and once again, you know, during his during his confirmation hearings, Rex Tillerson said it's not necessarily, you know, we're not going to have a policy of standing on a soapbox and lecturing everybody. And, you know, that may be just fine. You don't necessarily need to lecture every leader you talk to about things they might be doing. But first of all, that shouldn't stop you from expressing concerns. Second of all, that should be something that you adjust depending on what it is you're facing. What we've seen under Duterte is at least 8,000 people killed in cold blood since he took office in the Philippines. It's really a rampage in the guise of a war on drugs. It's really not the kind of thing that we've seen American leaders generally ignore.
So in terms, though, of this undercutting, and I don't know that Duterte is that popular in the country. I can't imagine. I think didn't the former defense chief, who was in many ways his mentor, distance himself from Duterte? What's your sense of whether this strongman that Trump appears to have an affinity towards is actually that popular in the country?
Well, I'd put it this way. He's popular enough. So there's disputes around what the polling shows. It all shows him doing quite well, certainly in the 70s, sometimes in the 80s in terms of approval. But his, you know, this tough guy, tough on crime, going to crack down, and his, you know, extending to his willingness to say basically, you know, criminals, thugs, drug dealers, if they end up dead, that's not a problem for me. That has not been unpopular. I think what is going to happen is if the Philippines suffers, you know, in terms of people's economic welfare, and then as people are impacted by these killings, you know, when it's someone that's their family or cousin or brother or mother or father or kid, it's going to start undermining his support. But I think he's popular enough that he can continue to get away with this. Moves within the Philippines to hold him accountable, even impeachment moves, haven't really gotten anywhere. He's been referred to the International Criminal Court by some Filipinos, and that's something that he's basically said, bring it on. I can't say how Trump and Duterte's relationship is going to affect what happens. They might be, you know, a bit of a match made in heaven, since they seem to both like to act like tough guys, and they seem to both be completely enamored by people who flatter them. But what we're seeing so far with Trump and Xi Jinping was that President Xi of China was able to flatter Trump quite effectively into backing off of pretty much all of his tough rhetoric about standing up to China, getting a better economic deal for Americans, taking care of any kind of territorial disputes. We don't see a hint of that from Donald Trump now. He had a phone call, and then they had chocolate cake in Mar-a-Lago, and he seems to now think that Xi Jinping is his best friend.
Well, he does owe the Chinese banks a lot of money, and it was pretty coincidental that his daughter, Ivanka, got all of her trademarks approved by China at the very moment they were consuming the chocolate cake and having her daughters sing in Mandarin, to serenading the Chinese leader and his wife. How much do you think business ties affect Trump's foreign policy? Because we've never had a president who is a businessman who has not divested himself of his business interests. He's actively, he still owns everything. He's supposed to not talk to his sons, which is ludicrous. And we know that some of Erdogan's cronies had invested in the Trump hotels in Istanbul. We know, for example, in the Philippines, that this 150 million, 57-floor Trump Tower in Manila is licensed through a guy called Jose Antonio, who Duterte appointed. He's Trump's go-to guy there, his partner. He's been appointed by Duterte as an envoy to Washington for trade, investment, and economic affairs. Is this what's going on in international relations? It's pretty hard to know where business deals end and traditional international diplomacy begins?
The simple fact is, due to the complete lack of transparency of the administration in Washington, we have no way of knowing. We have no way of knowing whether a business decision is affecting a policy decision that matters to the national security of the United States. All we know is where there are business ties and what could be at stake. We know there are these properties in the Philippines. We know the trademarks that were granted by China, and which had incidentally been in some cases pending for something like a decade, and are not things that are normally given very quickly. But following the election, all of a sudden these things are flowing, and the rhetoric about China is changing. What we know is we know where there are Trump-related businesses. We don't know how these businesses relate to each other. We don't know ownership structures. We don't know who's making money where. And we have no way of knowing what impact, if any, that is having on the decisions being made about American policy and American national security. It's a completely unprecedented situation. It should be deeply concerning to most people. I don't know that it's registered as much as it might, but it's the kind of thing that the administration should seriously take steps to clarify. And that doesn't really happen when your son-in-law, your daughter, still in their businesses, you still with all the ownership stake and with the rights to take profits at any time from your businesses, even though they're in a so-called trust. That kind of clarity can't happen in the environment we currently have.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm speaking with Vikram Singh, who is the Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Previously, he served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia at the Pentagon, where he advised senior leadership on all policy matters pertaining to development and implementation of defense strategies and plans for the region. So, but it's not as if we should be surprised, because I recall shortly after Trump's first announcement, where he insulted Mexicans and called them murderers and rapists, he then had a photo op at Trump Tower with an Indonesian bagman for General Prabowo, who had lost the election. And he was touting how he's going to do great deals with this guy. And now, of course, the military, the junta behind the scenes there, Prabowo being a part of the Suharto family, they're trying to get rid of this democratically elected leader, are they not, behind the scenes in Indonesia?
Well, I mean, a lot of the countries throughout the region have all sorts of political intrigue happening. What's generally been the case is that the United States is on the side of supporting democracy, supporting good governance, supporting increasing transparency and accountability of government all around the world, including all throughout this region. What we're seeing now is it's not just a matter of not wanting to lecture other countries. There seems to be an active policy choice from the administration to embrace, reassure folks like Duterte, folks like General Prayut, the leader of the military government in Thailand. And I'm not one to say we should be, you know, severing ties with these important partners because they have flawed, complicated, problematic leaders. But I would say that we should be engaging based on principles, and we should be exerting the influence that the United States has. The most strange thing here for somebody who says he knows how to make a deal and he knows how to, you know, use power and influence, the fact is that the United States, because it is so influential and powerful and such a big market, is in a position that's unique in the world to take a stand and to call for countries to live up to their better ideals and to not do things that are violations of the rights of their people. And we can't fix everything, but we can have an impact by virtue of our importance. So this is just giving that away, and it's completely misguided. It puts the ball in the courts of these other leaders. Duterte, for example, there's no upside to the United States and Duterte having a White House visit. President Trump is going to be in the Philippines in November for the East Asia Summit. He's already going to have FaceTime and give this guy whatever he needs in terms of legitimacy from, you know, getting a handshake with the U.S. president. This is sort of an unnecessary above and beyond. And it shakes the foundations of what actually makes America a country that has such disproportionate influence around the world.
Well, just in closing, Vikram Singh, is there any kind of connections here between the fact that Donald Trump is, of course, going to spend this money on this border wall, at least he plans on it, his attorney general has this peculiar obsession with marijuana and wants to revive the war on drugs, this very tough, get tough attitude on the idea? He talked about Mexican immigrants and drug dealers and MS-13. He talked about them being snakes in that talk he gave in Pennsylvania. This has some of the characteristics or echoes of Duterte's language, does it not?
they sound remarkably similar. I mean, articles have been written about how Trump is America's Duterte and vice versa. But what that simply means is that this is a populist leader who's appealing to people's fears rather than people's aspirations. And you know, that's something that you hope your democratic institutions can sort of stand up to when it gets to the worst. He didn't get any money for his wall in the budget deal that came through today. And we'll have to see how it goes. And as citizens, just be attuned to the fact that, you know, we're being rallied to some pretty ugly stuff. And hopefully we won't go along. In the Philippines right now, I think, you know, Duterte is sort of demonstrating that being a tough guy, authoritarian, can go pretty well. Some, you know, opponents are already at risk of being jailed if they haven't already been jailed, and it's really worrying. We have stronger institutions here, but all around the world, this is a tough time for democracy.
Well, Vikram Singh, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Vikram Singh, who's the Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Previously, he served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia at the Pentagon, where he advised senior leadership on all policy matters pertaining to development and implementation of defense strategies and plans for the region. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's ominous use of the label criminals.
There's a woman on my block. She'll just sit there facing the hill. She'll say, who's gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great
your mind. Politics needs human beings. Politics needs lives.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two on epistemology and one on philosophy of language and semantics, and one in social and political philosophy. His latest book is How Propaganda Works, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Who is a Criminal? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thank you, Ian.
So your piece in the New York Times starts out with your grandmother's 1957 book, The Unforgotten, where she describes how her husband's arrest and the arrest of German Jews by the Nazis, and initially they were arrested because they had petty criminal records and fines for speeding and traffic tickets, etc. And there's an unmistakable echo of what Jeff Sessions is doing now in broadening the mandate of ICE to, specifically, they've said that they want to get rid of the criminals, and Donald Trump talks about the MS-13 gangs and all these horrible criminal gangs. But the reality is people are being literally kicked out of this country, families being broken up because of traffic tickets. And that, unfortunately, and I know that's why you wrote the piece in the New York Times, but are we on some kind of slippery slope here, do you think?
We're unquestionably on some kind of slippery slope. And when you start with this strategy, history shows it's not retained to one group. I mean, of course, we need to be concerned, deeply concerned, with the violations of proportionality. I mean, exile is a brutal punishment, and we're exiling people. We're taking them away from their families. We're taking them away from their lives that they've created and rooted here. But what the administration is showing is that by calling a class of people criminals, they can get you to look the other way.
Well, but throughout the campaign, he also compared his political opponent as a criminal. You recall the refrain, lock her up, lock her up.
That's right. That comes next. I mean, it doesn't come next. As you said, it was part of the campaign. The opposition are criminals. The press are criminals. These are standard authoritarian tactics.
But is that an echo to the famous Pastor Nemo's admonition?
It is. It's Niemöller's admonition is, as I always tell my six-year-old son, it's the most important sentence you will ever hear. People think it's very, very normal to think, oh, it's not me, and to be relieved. But once you let an administration or a state violate proportionality, you know, exile people, deport them for minor crimes by convincing you they're criminals, then you're teaching them that that's a strategy they can use with other groups. So if you don't want it turned on yourself, you need to stop it at stage one. It's not possible to stop at stage four or stage five.
And again, the admonition is?
First, they came for the trade unionists, and I did not say anything because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not say anything because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the homosexuals, and I did not say anything because I was not a homosexual. I forget the different categories, but it ends with, and finally they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me.
Well, when you consider that right out of the gate, his first political announcement, when he announced he was running, he called Mexicans criminals, and it seemed so extraordinary at the time and so off the wall. But now here we are with him giving a speech on Saturday to his base, in essentially a campaign speech in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where he's up the ante and he's comparing immigrants, and largely obviously from the southern border, as poisonous snakes, and with rousing applause.
As poisonous snake. He's trying to... So Khalil Muhammad, in his book, The Condemnation of Blackness, talks about writing race into crime. And there's a long history in the United States, of course, of vilifying black Americans as criminals, and this has led to the current situation with our prisons, where 9% of the world's prison population is black American, even though there are only 36 million black Americans. And it's because there was this propaganda method after the civil rights movement, this Republican Southern strategy, to sort of demonize black Americans and connect them to criminality. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing that with immigration. If you look at, there was a study that came out in November looking at explicit dehumanization that looked, I don't have the study right now on my fingertips, but there was something like on markers of explicit dehumanization, like how do you view Mexican immigrants on a scale of one, where one is savage and criminal and seven is mature and responsible. People viewed Mexican immigrants, when you rank that scale from 1 to 100, they viewed them as 12 points less human than U.S. citizens who weren't Mexican immigrants. So, and with Muslims, even worse. The explicit dehumanization was even worse. So there's a very real toll that this kind of rhetoric takes. And he's directing it against the press as well, and, of course, against his opponents. So, you know, we see what he's doing, and he is taking action with respect to immigration. All 11 million undocumented people in the country are being targeted. That's been that's very clear from the policy, and so he's doing it. And so we know he does it. People are complacent, and it's shocking how complacent the press has become. The courts stopped the first two travel bans, but you know, and everyone cheers. But you know, that's in the first few weeks. You know, he's going to pack the courts, right? I mean, what's going to happen in a couple of years? So, I mean, people forget that Hitler came to power in 1933, and it was many years. It was years before the most extreme things started happening.
And he was, of course, Hitler was not voted in by a majority, and I think he only had a third of the seats. And Donald Trump, of course, as we know, didn't get a majority, and 3 million more voted for Hillary Clinton, and another 10 million voted for other opposition candidates. So he's very much a minority president in that context.
That's right, but he is doubling and tripling down on his supporters. So his supporters, he calls them the movement, and his supporters are getting ever more like followers. Like he said during the campaign, if I shot someone on Fifth Avenue in broad daylight, I wouldn't lose a single supporter. That's what he's aiming for. He's aiming for very passionate supporters who are completely revved up and ready to form a kind of bodyguard. I mean, you saw the bikers for Trump that he highlighted. He highlighted, you know, a row of bikers for Trump in his speech in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And, you know, the next phase is, you know, people who, you know, a kind of bodyguard, a militarized, that's what I'm concerned, one of our many concerns that we face. But he's definitely trying to create, as he calls it, a movement behind him, with him as the leader. And when you have 40% of the country who's willing to die for their leader, regardless of what he does, no matter how illegal his actions are, then it's extremely concerning, because the rest of the 60% can be cowed into submission by the threat of violence.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two in epistemology, one in philosophy of language and semantics, and one in social and political philosophy. His latest book is How Propaganda Works, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Who is a Criminal? And just to finish up in talking about the dehumanization by calling people snakes, immigrants in particular, as Trump did on Saturday, you point out in your article in the New York Times that when you refer to humans as animals, you're basically doing what the Rwandan genocide did with the Hutus, calling the Tutsis cockroaches and snakes. So
specifically they called them cockroaches and snakes. And snakes are very dangerous in Rwanda. And, of course, that poem is about a dangerous snake.
Sure. Well, let me try and find out then, I don't know when the Reichstag fire is going to happen, but I have a feeling it's in the wings and in the wind.
It is.
And I worry that what we're seeing now is the groundwork being laid for some kind of autocratic takeover of the United States with these willing executioners that we saw in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, cheering. What do you think then is the agenda behind the fact that Trump and Attorney General Sessions are out there? And Trump did this from day one, and apparently it's Bannon's writing. When he, in the inauguration, he talked about carnage. They are trying to portray America and the inner cities and the borders as crime-ridden, no-go zones, this dystopian dark vision of chaos and carnage that doesn't exist, yet he keeps pressing and keeps pushing this scenario. What is the agenda behind that, do you think?
That's, again, just completely classic. Classic. The agenda is to present himself as the protector, create fear. You find Trump supporters filled with fear about terrorism, non-existent U.S. terrorism, and immigrant crime. Immigrants have, of course, lower crime rates than non-immigrants. So create fear, create a sense that everything has spun out of control and only he can protect us. So that's create a sense of an emergency, because an emergency, as Carl Schmitt, the Nazi political theorist, taught us, when you declare an emergency, then people can suspend democratic liberties. So he wants to create a sense that the United States faces an emergency, and we need to go to have emergency actions against his opponents, who are to a large extent Black Americans, Muslims are the out-group. Muslims and immigrants are the out-group he's created. What he's promising is essentially the agenda is, of course, because that's what America First was about, but the agenda is to stop America from being a majority-minority country. And so he's creating this sense of rampant... So there's several goals here. One is to roll back the power of non-white groups and to deliver on the promise of to legitimate the sense that white civilization, you know, whiteness is law and order, to connect. Where is the carnage happening? Well, the carnage is supposed to be happening in places with non-white populations, and it's supposed to be caused by non-whites. So the agenda is to sort of justify white domination, and because at a time when the country shifts to have more and more non-whites, given the lengthy history of white domination, that creates a tremendous amount of anxiety among white populations, and always has. So that's number one. And number two is it's a way to justify anti-democratic measures, because in cases of emergency, you can suspend democratic liberties.
Well, of course, this atavism, I think, comes out of the demographic disquiet, if you will, that white people simply cannot get their heads around the possibility that being simply born white will no longer confer privilege.
That's right. And this is not just in the United States. This is an international thing. So Australia, you're Australian. I think this is, Australians have a history of this too.
The White Australia policy, it was called, yes.
Exactly. And right now, Australia is going through a vicious anti-immigrant moment. And a number of countries... Western Europe, of course, we're seeing it in Western Europe, though weirdly Trump's rise may blunt that because Trump is, let's say, not the best salesman for the kind of nationalism he represents. So I think we saw with Geert Wilders, and hopefully we'll see Marine Le Pen lose. But yes, these are very dangerous moments when you have one group that traditionally dominates society, and when that group, members of that group, see that they're no longer dominating the cultural airwaves, their story is not the only story. Well, that's going to be that, as a recent article in Foreign Policy said, few democracies survive that moment.
Well, let's just to finish up in the last couple of minutes, and I want to go back to the Reichstag fire just to get the sense of what could happen, because he's laid the groundwork, Trump. We now learn from the latest ABC Washington Post poll that 89% of Trump followers believe he's honest and trustworthy and will fulfill his promises. And 78% of his voters believe that the mainstream media propagates fake news. So we already have Trump is able to create fake news, which is real to his followers, at the same time demonizing the mainstream press like the New York Times for propagating fake news. So if there was a Reichstag fire provocation that he could blame on minorities or blacks or Democrats or Pocahontas or whoever, or Obama seems to be his favorite target, what do you see in terms of what will prick the bubble of his support base? And is there any chance that the fake news bubble could ever be pricked?
Well, people unfortunately have complacency here too. They're saying when he doesn't deliver for his base, well, go to Louisiana and look at Tea Party members and look at how they're doing. Ari Hochschild has a book about Louisiana where she interviews people who give up their town so pharmaceutical companies can move in. They willingly do that, and this is the history with. I mean. People have certain values, and these are non-material values, and Trump is making it so that he's their leader. He channels their deep values, profound values, and they're going to, as George Orwell says in his review of Mein Kampf, You know, liberal democracy says, we'll make your life better, we'll give you more food, we'll give you better jobs, you know, you'll have better health care. And then Hitler comes and promises you nothing but blood, suffering, and struggle, and people flock to Hitler. So Viktor Klemperer, in the language of the Third Reich, speaks of a soldier walking with an amputated arm in 1944, and Klemperer is walking with him, and the soldier turns to him and says, all this time, and Hitler never lied once to us. So, you know, his supporters believe that no matter how many things he says are false, he's channeling a deep truth. And the deep truth is that their traditions, their identity should dominate. And, you know, they're going to be willing to, and then he's using that connection with his supporters to delegitimize the press, to delegitimize any other authority other than him, because that's what authoritarianism is. By definition, authoritarianism is there's just one authority, the leader or the party, as in communist case. So you have to undermine truth. You have to undermine reality. And the party, or in this case, the leader, the nationalist leader, is using his bond of shared value to undermine reality. And so it's not just the news. It's not just the New York Times. What Trump is saying is, you know, I have this connection with you, and it's all about us. It's the movement. It's historical. It's world historical. You know, I define reality for you, because that's what authoritarianism is. He's the authority. So, you know, I don't think people are waiting around for people not to get jobs, and they're waiting. I mean, Trump is obviously completely, his economic policies benefit the titanically wealthy, but none of that is going to dissuade anyone. And the question of how to respond to authoritarians is a very difficult one. It's a very, very difficult one. How to address his supporters, that's very, very difficult. And I don't think we have an easy answer to how you address people who are fanatical.
Well, Jason Stanley, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate the conversation. And let's do another one when both of us will search for these answers, because I know our audience want them.
Indeed.
Thank you so much,
Ian, and thank you for your work.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of 4 books, 2 in epistemology, 1 in philosophy of language and semantics, and 1 in social and political philosophy. And his latest book is How Propaganda Works, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Who is a Criminal? We're going to take a brief station break, and on this May Day, we'll be looking into what happened to the champions of the middle and working classes, the Democrats.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, hitting low. Motion is perpetual. We call drill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. Where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dudes, don't let them play us. Girls, they are.
Bottom don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working band blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul. Tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us on this May Day is Jefferson Cowie, who holds a James G. Stallman Chair in American History at Vanderbilt University. He is the author of Staying Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, Capital Moves, RCA's 71-Year Quest for Cheap Labor. And his recent book is The Great Exception, The New Deal and the Limits of American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jefferson Cowie.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be here.
And on May Day, we, of course, here in the United States have never really fully throated support for May Day. It became a communist plot during the Cold War. But there are demonstrations around the country. So all is not lost in terms of reminding people that the work that workers do and their importance, even as they're being downsized, outsourced, and except for the coal miners, trashed by Donald Trump.
Well, and the real irony, of course, is that May Day is an American holiday. It was created as a result of the Haymarket affair tragedy after the Haymarket uprising in Chicago, and then exported abroad. But most our normal Labor Day was created as a sort of way to counteract the radical potential of the American May Day. So it's always good to realize the power relations that were at work within the May Day paradigm.
So let's talk a little bit about, in terms of your book, Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. The 1970s were also the last days of democratic power in this country in terms of a liberal opposition. In the 1970s, the Democrats controlled the House by an extraordinary margin. The Republicans were almost extinct, and the same was true of the Senate. The Supreme Court was dominated by liberals. And here we are a few decades later, and the Democratic Party has no leadership, is completely adrift. Donald Trump is making fun of them, talking about maybe they'll run Pocahontas. And yet the progressives and the liberals in this country are the ones that have done all the heavy lifting throughout our history, whether it, you know, goes back to getting rid of slavery, getting the women's vote, dealing with the Great Depression, dealing with the Nazi menace and the Japanese menace in World War II, and dealing with the civil rights movement. Had none of these things been dealt with, the country would have been in chaos and finished up long ago. And yet, while the liberals did all the heavy lifting, all the conservatives ever did was say no, no to everything. And now they're saying no to Obamacare, for example, in the same way. That's been their chorus, their litany. And so why are liberals defensive? Why are the Democrats on the defensive?
Well, I think that's a fantastic question, and it really is a question that cuts to the last 30 or 40 years of history since the 1970s. The Democrats made an enormous, or the liberals more broadly, I think made an enormous tactical mistake after the 1970s, which was they looked at the success of Reaganism, and they got scared. And so they went to a new Democratic DLC kind of model that stripped the heart and soul out of the liberal tradition and basically became Republican light, really didn't give a fighting opposition to the Republicans, and mostly lost on the other guy's arguments. I mean, you might as well get the real thing if you're going to vote for a conservative. So until they get a fighting faith back, I don't think I have much optimism for the Democrats.
Well, but Bernie Sanders proved that there is a constituency out there for an authentic leftist. And he wasn't even a Democrat. He was a Democratic Socialist. And, you know, I recall when he first started to run, all the pundits were saying, oh, my God, he insists on saying he's a Democratic Socialist. He's finished. Nobody can run in American politics who calls themselves a socialist. I mean, you know, and obviously the people out there, particularly the young, they saw him as being authentic. And the fact that he'd stuck by his principles and refused to be corralled and manipulated and molded by the mainstream media into accepting the political norms worked in his favor, not against him.
That, you know, I think you're exactly right, and so that illustrates my point exactly. You had somebody who had stepped out of the mainstream of the party, criticized the party, as well as the Republicans, and sought a sort of authentic voice that challenged this kind of what is really basically a bipartisan global elite, and you saw that on the Republican side too. Whatever your criticism, you know, we all have our criticisms of Trump, needless to say, but you had both basically a bolt from this system on the right and the left. I mean, I think the right is much more of a kind of a faux version of this, but nonetheless, you see a populist descent from this kind of complacent two-party system that's been ruling the country for the last several decades.
And again, I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, who holds the James G. Stallman Chair of American History at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of Staying Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, Capital Moves, RCA's 70-year Quest for Cheap Labor. And his most recent book is The Great Exception, The New Deal and the Limits of American Politics. So what do you think of Bernie Sanders' efforts then, Jefferson, to try and deal with the fact that identity politics have crippled the Democratic Party and the political left? As we saw in the last election, Hillary Clinton ran on a kind of potpourri of identity politics and was never seen as being authentic. And a lot of working class, blue collar people who voted for Obama ended up voting for Trump. Bernie Sanders is making the case that we've got to deal with the issues that unite us, like economic disparity and inequality, as opposed to various issues involving gender and race and other aspects of identity politics.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think Sanders tried to unite the country in terms of or the working class on economic grounds, but his capacity to work around the questions or deal directly with the questions of identity politics were pretty ham-fisted. I think, you know, I think it's Nancy Fraser, the political philosopher, said you can't have economic rights without recognition. You can't have recognition without economic rights. You know, they're connected. And so you need to find a kind of a more delicate balance, I think, than Sanders did in that particular thing. But I think his impulse is correct, that we all need health care. We all need good-paying jobs. We all need rights on the job. We all need the right to non-discrimination, all these sorts of things. But you can't just sort of pretend that that will mask over really complex questions about race, gender, sexuality, and things like that. So trying to talk about both at the same time within a framework of economic unity, I think, is the next stage of this struggle.
So if you accept the historical notion that the U.S. was arguably a social democracy from, say, 1944 to 1977, and it's always struck me as a massive irony that the Marshall Plan and post-World War II, the U.S. installed social democracies in Germany and throughout Western Europe and in Japan. And then they have full health care. They have 6 weeks vacation. They have pregnancy leave. They have all the things that the American worker and the middle-class Americans could only dream of. Those are taken for granted. The unions in Germany have half the seats on the boards of directors of all the major companies. And here we have a little flirtation with trying to revive social democracy.
An anemic healthcare.
Yeah. And you've got Bernie Sanders out there trying to revive it. Yeah. And here they are trying to roll back this sort of hopelessly compromised corporate insurance effort on Obama's part, because they politically can't bite the bullet for single payer. Mm-hmm. And so my question is there a way to break through this bubble of propaganda that's basically got working Americans thinking that the Canadians are all dropping dead in the street because they've got free health care, that you could basically come up with this idea that, wait a minute, why don't we start voting for people who are good stewards of our taxes and give us something back in return, instead of sending all of our money to the military-industrial complex, agribusiness, and right-wing welfare?
Yeah, as long as 60% of the federal government discretionary budget goes to defense and not to take care of people, essentially, you know, to kill people and control the globe rather than taking care of our people at home, we're not going to get anywhere. And I think getting off this sort of foreign policy crack that unites the country in this very sort of thin patriotic nationalistic way, we're not really going to be able to break away from that, because we're spending plenty of money. We're just not spending it in a socially useful place. But then if we return back to your original point, which was the rise of social democracies in the post-war era in those other countries, much of the reason that happened was there was a vibrant political left in those countries, right? And so those are compromises between kind of mainstream liberal politicians and an insurgent left that was very scary in the post-war period. And so you would make those compromises. And I think that's sort of one of the problems that we have to think about now is how you create a vibrant democratic movement that challenges the status quo to provide more redistributionary functions instead of just sending money off it to this sort of military Keynesian system that we have.
But given that the Republican Party now is morphing away from conservatism into nationalism, and that seems to be, I think, an ongoing trend that will probably survive post-Trump, what can the opposition do in terms of harnessing, if you will, a positive form of nationalism? In other words, we're all in this together. It should be patriotic to help your fellow American to have a better life.
Well, I think this was a tactical mistake that liberals on the left made, too, was sort of this cosmopolitan internationalism went a little too far. I've often thought that the nation state is the place of redress for the vast majority of Americans. That's where you look. That's where you vote. That's where you want your issues taken care of. And so I think this sort of vague cosmopolitanism was always quite a slippery slope for people who wanted to get things people are worried about, you know, jobs, healthcare, you know, the fundamentals. And so I'm sort of excited about this sort of patriotic nationalist impulse. I think it can be shaped because we're now saying, even in a global world, we are going to stake our claims for what we're about on the national level. Now that's a level you can deal with. That's a level you can regulate on. That's a level that you can redistribute things from. It doesn't have to be this sort of pie in the sky global system that we need to look to. And I think that's a positive thing. That's a possibly democratic space.
Well, but this is the amazing thing, is that both on the left and on the right, there is incredible alienation in this country. In other words, if you talk about social democracy, that's the citizen engaged with the government and feeling like there's a transaction. I pay my taxes, you give me services, and that's the deal. Here, you don't get much for your taxes, but pointed out, the military-industrial complex and right-wing welfare are all first at the trough. So is there a way that, for example, Trump's success is largely because of the alienation that's out there in working in middle-class America? They just feel the government has abandoned them, and they're not wrong.
Absolutely
the
correct.
Alienation on the left is also sort of, a lot of it's sort of stupid and infantile, the idea that, you know, in other words, if you think the government's some conspiracy of five white guys in a back room, then you're never going to do anything except gaze at your navel. I mean, alienation by definition means that you're inactive. You know, it's your government. Take it back. I mean, if, for example, the lunatic Tea Party people can capture the Republican Party, why can't progressives like Bernie Sanders capture the Democratic Party?
Well, it might be happening. I think that's the possibility here. I think that we're seeing a major, I hate the word disruption, it's been used in really unfortunate ways in the last few years, but you're seeing a tremendous disruption in the structure of both parties right now. And you're absolutely right that the Republicans have now become sort of, by default, they have to bring the state back in. There's discussion of infrastructure, jobs policy, you know, industrial policy, things like that were taboo. And on the left, you see similar discussions, both of which are abandoning this kind of bipartisan elite. And I'm very excited about that. I think what direction it goes is very volatile and scary. And whoever wins, I think, will be, it'll depend a lot about organization and things like that. But some of my biggest disappointments coming out of the Obama era is some of the tools were not provided coming out. I think things like filibuster, things like campaign finance reform to get money out of politics would have been much more fundamental, basic approaches to some of these big problems that might have helped lay the future for more dramatic changes.
Well, clearly, on the day after Trump's inauguration, there was this spontaneous outpouring of resistance from millions, yeah, millions of women, both in this country and around the world. I think they were the biggest marches probably in the history of the country, and they've continued for over climate change and other issues. Now, today on May Day, there are demonstrations all around the country as well, and there are going to be upcoming demonstrations to save the arts because Trump and the Republicans want to get, get rid of the arts and get rid of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is going to certainly affect public radio, et cetera. So people are stepping up. It's almost as if, in spite of the Democratic Party, there's this massive opposition out there. Do you think that it, that opposition can be harnessed politically? I don't see a pantheon of leaders out there. Bernie's getting older. Joe Biden is too old. What's your sense of when the opposition movement is going to be met with political leadership?
No, I think that the next generation of leadership is actually going to be pretty young. When that, the post-Trump protest I was at, I could not believe that the energy of people who are under 30, not college age, but like late 20s, many from minority communities who were really out in front of those protests. And so I was actually quite impressed by the skills and energy that a lot of those folks are bringing to the movement. So we'll see. The real problem is, I think, money, that the right has so much money, so much resources, that free speech is money, that the votes can be bought, that Congress is expensive, and so you need a lot of organizing to overcome those levels of inside power.
But just in closing, you're talking about demonstrations that took place in Tennessee, which is a red state, right?
Exactly. Oh, yeah. No, right here in Nashville. It was amazing. It went on for hours. I mean, people were filing through the city for hours here. Nashville is a, you know, a little blue island in a red state, but still, people came in from all over the place, and it was an amazing demonstration against Trump that Saturday after the inauguration.
So you don't think they necessarily have to go away? Are they bubbling on the back burner? What's your prognosis of
what's going to go away? I'm sorry.
Where does it go to?
Oh, right. Well, that's the question. I think there's a hopeful wake-up call here. In 2008, everyone elected Obama and then sat back and waited for the change to happen. I think the Trump victory really drove down, such as it is, the mixed victory of Trump, it really drove the point home that you really need to not just be a spectator in politics, but you have to participate in politics. And I think that's a lesson I've heard all over the state and all over the country. And I think people's sort of orientation towards politics has actually changed as a result of the 2016 election.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today on May Day, Jefferson Cowie.
Happy May Day, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jefferson Cowie, who holds the James G. Stallman Chair in American History at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of Stayin' Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor. And his most recent book is The Great Exception, The New Deal and the Limits of American Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.